For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.
But we begin with a developing story.
Boston police officer John O'Keefe.
John O'Keefe.
Was found face up in the snow on Saturday morning.
Outside a home currently occupied by people known to O'Keefe.
Officer Saraf observed the victim to be cold to the touch, no signs of breath.
He was transported to the Good Samaritan Medical Center where he was pronounced dead.
State prosecutors accused Karen Reed, who was O'Keefe's girlfriend, of backing into him and leaving him to die in the snow.
Reed and the victim had been out drinking at a couple of bars in town the night before when they were later invited back to a home on Fairview Road.
She stated that she dropped the victim off and left.
Reed's attorney says she tried to call O'Keefe and had no idea anything had happened to him.
Reed pleaded not guilty to manslaughter, motor vehicle homicide, and leaving the scene of a crash causing death.
An investigation into the death of a Boston police officer in Canton has taken a turn. Lawyers for the woman under arrest not only say their client is innocent, they're alleging a cover-up.
Prosecutors point to pieces of a broken taillight as evidence, but her lawyers argue the police report was altered.
First got to that scene at 6 a.m. and did not find a single piece of taillight. And then 12 hours later, boom, they found taillight everywhere.
People in this town are scared of the people who are supposed to protect and serve.
I don't think there's any kind of conspiracy or anything like that.
They say there were a lot of people at the home that night, and one of them Googled how long to die in the cold hours before Reed would have known O'Keefe was missing.
Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed! Free Karen Reed!
This is not a Hollywood star. This is an accused murderer getting a standing ovation as she enters the courtroom. What is going on out there?
I remember growing up, one of my mom's favorite TV shows was Unsolved Mysteries. I can still remember the uneasy feeling I would get when the first few notes of that sinister theme song began to play, and then Robert Stack's haunting voice would come on as he laid out pieces of an unfinished puzzle. He's giving clues to a possibility of what could have happened, but leaving us without any definite answers. Just enough information to give us hope that if we just look at it hard enough or think about it long enough, we can figure out exactly what happened and solve the mystery. When the episode would come to a close, I can remember being on the edge of my seat, unintentionally holding my breath, waiting to see if they had the update segment to pull everything together and answer all of my questions. Or if we were going to be all left to try to figure it out on our own and solve it ourselves, chasing that satisfaction that we get when we place those last pieces of a 1,000-piece puzzle, or when we read those last few chapters of a suspense novel. The reassurance that, while tragic and scary and wild, this case is solved and justice was served. I think it's that desire to have all the answers that drew me into the tragic death of Boston police officer John O'Keefe and the indictment and arrest of his girlfriend, Karen Reed. I first heard about this case briefly when Karen was arrested. 46-year-old, off-duty Boston police officer John O'Keefe found unresponsive in the snow outside a home in Canton, Massachusetts. His girlfriend, Karen Reed, charged with manslaughter, motor vehicle homicide, and leaving the scene of a collision causing death. It wasn't long before this story was back in my newsfeed as a group of Karen Reed supporters began to make some noise, claiming that she was being framed. Honestly, I didn't think too much of it because with every trial I cover and every case I watch play out, there are always the ones who will say that the accused is being framed, no matter how much evidence there is against them. I always say that reasonable doubt has to be reasonable, and it doesn't usually take long for the conspiracy theorist to quiet down as evidence comes out and the doubt becomes less and less reasonable. But there's a difference in reasonable doubt of guilt and belief of actual innocence. And even with the belief of actual innocence, the belief that someone is being framed, well, that's a whole new ballgame. The first piece of evidence that really piqued my interest and made me start kind of paying attention to this story was the taillight.
Prosecutors point to pieces of a broken taillight as evidence of this, but her lawyers argue the police report was altered. They say pieces of her taillight weren't found until after her car was taken into custody.
Yannetti accused investigators of doctoring Reed's SUV. He says he has evidence it was in different condition after police impounded it.
So it's not just social media antagonists. Her lawyers are actually saying that they have evidence of this. Well, my interest is piqued. So I find another local news report from NBC Boston about the lead detective and his association with the owner of the home where John O'Keefe was found dead.
They were drinking with friends the night he died. One of them, a Canton police officer. O'Keefe's body was found in front of that officer's home. To avoid a conflict, the state police took over the investigation. But Reed's attorney, David Yannetti, says the opposite happened.
The lead detective is very close with the owners of that property. And he was supposedly assigned to the case to avoid the appearance of impropriety.
Anytime there's a cover-up, there's always someone involved who has two things. One is powerful connections, as in a very close relationship between the lead detective and the owner of the home where John O'Keefe was found. And number two, something to hide.
They say there were a lot of people at the home that night, and one of them Googled how long to die in the cold hours before Reed would have known O'Keefe was missing.
This is what got me. Everything up to this point could potentially be explained away. John was a cop. It's not strange that he's hanging out with other cops who also know other cops. The taillight. It wouldn't be the first piece of evidence that I've seen arguments over, and at this point, I hadn't taken the time to dig in on specifics, so I didn't know what was involved in that. But this. Someone inside the home that night asked Google how long it takes someone to die in the cold. But yet, if Karen really backed over John O'Keefe, then he would have never made it inside the home. So why would someone inside the home be asking Google such a specific question? And the specifics of that question, why how long to die in the cold? That wording, almost like you've dropped someone out in the cold to die and you're wanting to know how long that process is going to take. And if you did that, well, that would be part two, something to hide. So down the rabbit hole I went. When I chose Justice for John O'Keefe for my next deep dive, I didn't really know what I was signing up for, because this case just keeps getting more and more complicated. The small town connections run deep. Beyond just the lead detective's connection to Brian Albert, who owned the home where John O'Keefe's body was found, the Alberts also have connections to the Attorney General's office, to a firefighter that was on scene, who was actually the only responder to give a statement, and even to the judge. And it's impossible to report on this case without acknowledging the bitter debates from both sides about the interpretation of evidence. Now, don't get me wrong, almost every case has an element of this to a degree. There are hashtags on Twitter and discussion groups on Facebook and forums on Reddit, all full of true crime enthusiasts and self-proclaimed sleuths who basically pick sides and debate out the details as the case unfolds. But this one's different. The fiery debates and the demand for justice go beyond just social media and subreddits. The court of public opinion has permeated into the court of law in a way that I don't think I've witnessed before. There are impassioned protests on the courthouse steps, angry videos from the Norfolk County District Attorney addressing the public, and even an interview where the lead detective questions a potential witness about his interaction with a blogger who's been reporting on the case. There are accusations that the defense is paying bloggers and protesters to spread their theory around the court of public opinion, hoping that it works in favor of their client. There are accusations that the Albert family is working their connections with law enforcement and officials to frame Karen, setting her up to take the blame for John's death in order to protect one or more of their own family members who were there that night. With every new detail comes a new controversy, and nothing is what it seems on the surface. So here's what we know. John O'Keefe, who went by the nickname JJ to his friends, was born and raised in Braintree, Massachusetts. He attended Northeastern University, then he went on to earn his master's in criminal justice from UMass. John had been a Boston police officer for 16 years. His sister passed away in 2013, and her husband, John's brother-in-law, passed away the following year, leaving John to raise his niece and nephew. He was described as well-loved and liked by all, and his family describes him as having a huge heart. Karen Reed is beautiful and successful and also incredibly smart. She graduated from the Bentley College Elkin B. McCallum Graduate School of Business and had a Bachelor's of Science in Finance from Bentley University. With accelerated studies, Karen was able to graduate in 3 years and was a presidential scholar. She spent the last 13 years as a faculty member at Bentley University, and she also worked in equity research for Fidelity Investments. Karen lived with John and his niece and nephew, and she says that they were very much in love. She describes him as very selfless, frugal, and says you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who didn't care for him. She even jokes that he was the patron saint of Canton. John and Karen dated in their 20s. They lost touch for a while and then reconnected through Facebook during the pandemic. She thought it was incredibly admirable how he stepped up to take care of his niece and nephew. And as things got more serious between them, she kept the home that she owned, but she began to spend most of her time at John's with him and the kids. Like any relationship, there were hard times. Karen said that as time passed, John began to rely on her more to take care of the kids. But she also felt like he criticized some of the decisions that she made with them, which could cause some tension between them. According to court documents, John's niece and nephew told investigators that it wasn't uncommon for John and Karen to argue, and Karen allegedly told authorities that they had argued that morning because of what Karen fed his niece for breakfast. But is that motive for murder? Surveillance video collected from the bar that night shows Karen and John looking happy and affectionate. John and his friend Michael got to C.F. McCarthy's bar around 7:30 p.m. Then Karen arrived just before 9. They hang out, drink for a couple of hours, then go to the Waterfall Bar around 11 o'clock to meet up with the Alberts and McCabes. Now, there are a lot of connections here between the Alberts, the McCabes, and the various police departments, and it gets really complicated. I'll have a family tree up on the episode guide for reference on 13thjurorpodcast.com, and we'll get more in depth into everything as the season progresses, but for now, I'm going to keep it really simple. Brian and Nicole Albert own the home where John's body was found. Like John O'Keefe, Brian is also a Boston police officer. Also with them that night were Brian's brother and Nicole's sister and their spouses. Brian's brother, Chris Albert, and his wife, Julie, knew John O'Keefe, and Julie is actually the one who texted John and told him that they were at Waterfall to get down there. Chris is on the Select Board, and for those not familiar with that, the Select Board, or Board of Selectmen, is the executive arm of the government of New England towns in the United States, usually consisting of just a handful of elected people. Nicole's sister, Jen McCabe, that's a name you'll hear come up often in this case. Not only was she with Karen when Karen found John's body, but there's a lot of controversy over her phone records and Google searches. She was with her husband, Matt McCabe. There was also another friend named Brian Higgins, who's a member of ATF and has an office at the Canton Police Department. Another married couple, Karina and Nicholas, were also there. And according to the statement on record from Nicole's interview filed by Sergeant Bukinick, Nicole's daughter Tristan and Tristan's boyfriend were there. Now, something to note here, her daughter's name is not Tristan, it's Caitlin. And Caitlin's boyfriend's name is Tristan. This is a huge thing to get mixed up. But Also, the sergeant says in that statement that he and Trooper Proctor from the state police went to interview her and they formally introduced themselves. Now, the reason I point this out is because it's making it sound like they're unknown to this family, and Trooper Proctor is not unknown to them. As a matter of fact, remember that blogger that we mentioned before? His name is Aiden Carney, and he's known to his followers as Turtle Boy. He's been following this case for a while and is one of, if not the, loudest voice in the room when it comes to Karen's innocence. On his website, tbdailynews.com, Turtle Boy shows where he's done some digging on the connections of these families, and there's a lot. While having various connections in a small town, especially for members of law enforcement, isn't a big deal, hiding those connections between the lead investigator and the family where a dead body was found, that is. In fact, the Alberts' connection to Proctor goes beyond just Proctor himself. Their families are intertwined. There were pictures found on social media of Trooper Proctor and his niece, along with two of the children of Jen McCabe. More about that later. There are also social media posts showing family members of Proctor mentioning the Alberts and how they love their kids, and there's even wedding pictures showing Albert family members, one of which was at the house that night, at Proctor's sister's wedding. Not only was he at the wedding, he was in the wedding. There are wedding photos of Colin Albert, who was at the home that night, pictured with Proctor and others. Yeah, this gets messy. And it's only just beginning. Like I said, right now, I'm just keeping it simple. Something to note here is that the story, along with information from court documents and reports, tends to vary and even change. It will be too complicated and confusing to try to tell you all of the inconsistencies and changes right away. So as we dig in to each aspect of this, I'll be more specific with it. For now, we're going to go with some of the original information. There are a lot of unanswered questions, things that I would expect to be present in the probable cause affidavit, but there are so many things missing and important data left out. If you're interested in seeing the timeline put together with timestamps, there's a great and really helpful Google Doc that has been put together on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it these days by Sleuthy, whose Twitter handle is @SleuthyGoosey. She has different tabs with a timeline, discovery, and links to court documents all in one spot. She's like me in that she's a stickler for details and data, so I'm going to reference her timeline here based on interviews and statements, phone location data, video footage, call records, and grand jury testimony. So we know that the homeowners, Brian and Nicole Albert, were having people come back to their house that night when they left the bar. It was their son, Brian Jr.'s birthday, and he had some friends over earlier, some that were still there and some that were going back to the house to keep the party going. Jen McCabe invited John and Karen to come along. We know that Karen exits the Waterfall Bar with two females, according to video footage, at about 12:10, and 1 minute later, John exits as well, carrying a short cocktail glass in his hand. That glass becomes very important later. Phone location data shows Jen McCabe leaving the area around 12:13 and 46 seconds. Within a minute, John texts her asking where to. Jen then calls John. He answers, and there's a 44-second conversation. But this conversation is deleted from Jen's phone before she turns it over. It's only found when they do the complete download of the phone. While that itself is not very incriminating, it's a pattern that we're going to look at more, so I want to go ahead and mention it now. At 12:15, there's video footage of a large black SUV that matches the description of Karen's Lexus traveling on Washington Street. So let's talk a little bit about 12:15, because there are some other things that are said to happen at this time as well. In one of the interviews given, 12:15 is also when Caitlin, Brian and Nicole's daughter, was apparently picked up by her boyfriend Tristan Morris and left the house. You'll remember that statement from Nicole that had her name listed wrong? Well, it may have been listed wrong, but we do know that they were out at Waterfall Bar and Grill together. So it's not impossible that somehow they left there and then a short time later, her boyfriend is picking her up from her house after midnight, even though they had been out together just before this. It's not impossible, but it's an interesting note to make, and one that we will get deeper into when we do our episode about the controversy surrounding who was there that night.
Also, back at the house, one of Brian Jr.'s friends, Julie Nagel, has called her brother Ryan to come pick her up. According to grand jury testimony, he arrives with his friend Richie, who drove, and his girlfriend Heather at 12:15 in an F-150 to pick Julie up. He says as they approach Fairview Road, headlights of a midsize black SUV come from the opposite direction on Cedar Crest, so they yield to the SUV that then turns right onto Fairview, and they make a left onto Fairview right behind them. It's important to note here that the grand jury testimony says this was at 12:15, but there are no times listed on the February 7th interview with Ryan. And John's phone data shows that he didn't actually arrive to the Alberts house until 12:24. I know it's only a 9-minute discrepancy, but there are so many discrepancies that I want to make sure that we note them. So his description would put both cars driving in the direction of the house, which will be on their right side when they reach it. When they get there, Ryan said that Richie stops the truck right in front of the house, and the black SUV in front of them stopped along the curb toward the left side of the property as you look at the home from the street. So basically just further along the road from where they stopped. They were out there for no longer than 5 minutes, and he said Julie decided that she wanted to stay and possibly spend the night there. He says he looked up and he saw the SUV had moved up some, along the edge of the property by the flagpole and some bushes. He said that it looked like the car wasn't in park because the rear brake lights were illuminated. Ryan said that they drove on past the SUV and the interior light was on. A Caucasian female was seated in the driver's seat, holding the steering wheel at a 10-2 position, looking ahead. He said that he didn't see anyone else inside, and he also didn't see the SUV leave and didn't see any damage to it. He said that it had started snowing about half an hour before all of this, so there was a coat of snow on the ground. Now, let's look at this block of events and compare notes. Jen McCabe arrives at her sister's house at 12:18, according to her phone location data. At that same time, 12:18, she gets a call from John, and they have a 36-second conversation, which, according to the PCA, was him asking where the house was located. So far, so good. 1 minute later, at 12:19, is John's first cell phone location data point in the neighborhood, so it looks like he and Karen aren't far behind Jen, which means Ryan in the F-150 with Richie and Heather are getting there around the same time also. But this is where things start getting messy. Jen said in her February 1st interview that someone said there's a car outside. So she looks out the window and she sees a car that she says she can't describe because she's not good at doing that, but she assumes it was John and Karen. Now, this is interesting because according to Ryan's statement, they pulled up in front of the house in a truck, and John and Karen pulled further toward the edge of the yard in the SUV. So if someone said there's a car outside, did nobody notice that there were two cars outside? One car and one truck? And how difficult would it be to tell the difference in a truck and an SUV? This is an F-150 and a Lexus SUV. According to her statement, when someone announced the car being outside, she went to look and she just assumed it was them. So according to Trooper Proctor's PCA, he says that Jen observed the black SUV arrive from the front door. That's a big discrepancy that really matters if we're talking about John getting hit by a car and left for dead in the front yard. So Jen said that since someone said the car is there and she saw it and assumed it was them, she then texts John at 12:21 and asks if he's there. So according to her, at 12:21, someone has already seen them, but they only saw one SUV, no truck, and she looked out there, she thinks it's them, so she texts him, "Are you here?" at 12:21. But John's phone location data doesn't show his arrival to the house until 12:24, 3 minutes after she's texting him because she saw the car that she assumed was them. The call records show that the text where Jen is asking if John is there didn't actually get sent until 12:27. Again, less than 10 minutes, but the devil's in the details, y'all, and I want to make sure that we're getting all of the information there. Jen's February 1st interview
says that she then texted John at 12:31 to pull behind her vehicle. Though, according to Proctor's PCA, Jen said that her text at 12:31 said, "Hello." Cell records don't actually show a text at 12:31, but they do have a phone call. Jen called John at 12:29. He answered, and there was an 8-second call. Now, not only was this call not mentioned, but it's another one that she deleted from her call history. What did they talk about for those 8 seconds? 11 minutes later, records show that she texted John, "Hello." Though on her interview, she said the 12:40 text was, "Where are you?" And on the PCA, Proctor said the 12:40 text was, "Pull up behind me." So again, 3 different versions of what's happening. Jen then calls John 2 more times at 12:41. Both are unanswered, and she deletes those as well. She mentions in her February interview that she knows that there was a call there, but claims that it was a pocket dial as she was putting her phone in her pocket. There's one more deleted text to John at 12:42 asking, "Where are you?" Now, look, these inconsistencies wouldn't be a big deal if these were guest times, but these are official documents given with specific times that don't add up. Another inconsistency in the reports here. Jen's interview documents say when she looked out the window a while later, the car had moved to the left. In the PCA, Trooper Proctor claims that Jen saw the car move from the original spot to the left of the house. Something else that doesn't add up. Jen's February 1st interview states that the next time she looked out the window, the car was gone. But in the PCA, Trooper Proctor said that Jen said she texted John hello and then saw the car drive away. Again, these are huge details to have discrepancies on. Now, I'm not saying that it's because somebody's lying. I'm not saying that it's because there's shoddy police work. I'm saying that discrepancies are there for some reason, and we don't know what that reason is yet. There are 3 more times that Jen calls John between 12:46 and 12:50 and deletes them all from her call records. The inconsistencies don't stop there. There's a statement given that says all guests left the Albert residence by 1 a.m. But at grand jury, there's testimony that Brian Higgins left the house to go to Canton Police Department to do administrative work at 1:30 a.m. I think it's interesting to note also that to leave the house and go to Canton Police Department to do administrative work at 1:30 a.m. after having been out all night and been at the bar, it's just something to make note of. Now, having said that, we don't know if he was drinking. We don't know if he had anything scheduled. This isn't something that is in any of the reports as of right this moment in the investigation. More on that later. Some more inconsistencies. Also at 1:30, Jen and Matt McCabe are said to leave, and they, in one statement, are said to drive Brian Jr.'s 2 friends home. That would be Julie and Sarah. In another statement, they are said to just drive Julie home. So one statement says everybody left by 1. A couple of statements say by 1:30. But Jen's phone location data shows that she actually left the house at 1:47 a.m. At 2:03, she turns right on Lawrence Street, according to her phone location, and then at 2:04 on Leonard Way, her course is reversed, and at 2:12, she arrives home. Now, if she pulled out of the house at 1:47 a.m. and all of the people in the house left by this time, this would be Brian Higgins, Jen and Matt McCabe, 2 of Brian Jr.'s friends, all leaving the house by 1:47 a.m., and nobody saw a body. The timeline continues to get incredibly controversial here. Records show that about 10 minutes after Jen gets home, she unlocks her phone. She sends a couple of texts at 2:25. She deletes 2 screenshots at 2:26. And this is the biggest, most controversial part of all of this right now. Everything to do with the phone data and the timeline and the McCabes and there being anything
known to anybody else or there being any kind of conspiracy to frame Karen Reed. At 2:27 a.m., Jen does an internet search for how long to die in the cold. She actually spells how wrong, and she types it in as H-O-S, long to die in cold, at 2:27 and 40 seconds. But that's not the only cell data controversy. There are no steps recorded on Jen's watch or phone from 1:37 a.m. until 1:41 a.m., which would be the time that she would be driving home. Now, at 1:44 a.m., after she has arrived home, there are 137 steps counted, and then there's 44 after that, and 98, and then 20, and 102. The steps continue on her phone for a moment, and then on her watch the entire time. There's not another point of time where she's not taking steps, according to her data, until 5:31 a.m., which is about the time that she is back in her car, driving again to go meet Karen. Now, to those who are on the side of the prosecution's theory, this could just be nothing. They explain it away, that it could be anything that causes this to happen. But I know that there is some controversy about how you look at step data, but this is actually from her watch. This isn't just her phone that could be somehow banging around while she's in bed asleep. It doesn't really make sense. So I know that this is a point of contention, and we will get into more of the science stuff of this when we get to that episode. Right now, I'm just trying to give the overview of all the controversy and all the different parts that are causing so much controversy. It's about 4:30 a.m. when John's niece is woken up by Karen. According to court documents, Karen is distraught that John didn't come home, so she has John's niece actually call Jen. It's 4:53 a.m., according to the statement, when they call Jen about John not coming home. At 4:59 a.m., Jen calls John's phone. Of course, it's unanswered, and that call is also deleted. Carrie Roberts, a friend, gets a call from Karen and says, according to the statement, John didn't come home. And she says that Karen said, "John's dead. Carrie, I wonder if he's dead. It's snowing. He got hit by a plow." The plow driver is also something that is a huge point of contention in this case. Now, remember how I said everybody left, and depending on which statement you go by, it could be 1 a.m. or it could be 1:30 or it could be 1:47. Well, this was when it had just started snowing, about 30 minutes, according to one of the statements, before they got to the Alberts' house after leaving the bar. But it wasn't snowing much at first, but this was the start of a pretty big snowstorm. With any big snowstorm or any snow that's going to be on the ground at all affecting traffic, of course they're going to have snowplow drivers come. In an interview with Lucky, the snowplow driver who was actually working the route in front of the Alberts' home that night, he says from 2:30 until about 3, there was a Ford Edge parked in front of 34 Fairview Road toward the left of the property facing Chapman, which is the same direction that both the car and the truck pulled in earlier. Honestly, I think we could end up doing an entire episode on the snowplow driver because there's so much to this. Lucky wasn't interviewed by police until after he was contacted and gave a statement to Turtle Boy. In that interview, he said that he didn't see a body by the road in front of that house, and it's something that he would have seen. There are huge controversies over not only his statement, but the handling of Lucky and the information that's being left off the records, the statement about the Ford Edge, the name of the plow company. This is going to be something that we get really in depth in later on. Continuing the timeline, at 5:07 a.m., video footage shows Karen backing her car out of John's garage, at which point she strikes his car behind her. This is another huge debate.
In the video, you can barely see the wheel and tire of John's car shift. It's just the slightest little bit, and I didn't see it at first. I didn't think it was actually happening. I had to slow it down and zoom in for me to actually be able to see it. But you can see a shift in the tire, or I could anyway, when she backs into it. Now, it just so happens that this is the same corner where the taillight is broken on her car. So this sparked another huge debate. Could this be how her taillight gets busted, not from hitting John? In a future episode, we're going to go into detail about the inconsistencies with the taillight and the theories surrounding them, because this is another one of the major parts of this case. There's a search done by Canton police at the Alberts home when there's no taillight pieces that are found, and John is missing a shoe. Later in the day, when state troopers took over, not only was the shoe found, but there were also at least 35 pieces of the taillight that were collected. This is something that we're going to dive deep into as well, because this was the seventh biggest snowstorm in Boston's recorded history. So there's a lot of controversy over whether or not those pieces were missed because of the storm, or if it makes it even less likely they were found after because of the storm. If they weren't found before and snow kept falling, then it would make them less likely, according to the defense's side, to have been able to find that many pieces later. So Jen McCabe and Carrie Roberts are going to go with Karen to go look for John. Location data shows that they go near waterfall, and during this time, Jen calls Tom Betty, but this is also part of her deleted phone calls. And she also calls John multiple times, and she calls Nicole. All of these are deleted. According to documents, Carrie drove the women to Albert's house, and with Karen sitting in the back seat, Jen said that she saw John's body in the snow right away. They said she screamed, jumped out of the car, ran over to where he was lying, and she laid on top of him in an attempt to keep him warm and tried to do CPR. According to Jen, she says that Karen yelled to her to Google, "How long do you have to be left in the cold before you die?" This is the state's version of why that search was on Jen McCabe's phone. But remember, the documents from the defense, from the cell phone expert, say that this wasn't done at this time in the morning. That search was done at 2:27 a.m. But that's not all. At 6:23 a.m. and 49 seconds, Jen searches, "How long does it take to digest food?" It's a few seconds after that that she actually searches, "How long does it take to die in the cold?" But she, again, doesn't say it right or spell it right. It's how long. Two is spelled T-I, die in, and then cold is spelled C-I-K-D. Then there's another search done at 6:24 a.m. and 18 seconds for how long to die in cold, where how is again spelled H-O-S. 11 minutes later, after that search, Jen calls Matt McCabe. The state police are contacted, and Proctor is called within a few minutes and made aware of the situation. Jen gets a call back from Matt at 6:47 a.m., and they talk for 18 seconds, and that one is also deleted. Now, it's also important to note, while they're outside and John's body is laying in their yard and all of this is happening, nobody from inside that house comes outside. They don't come to speak to police. They don't come to check on any of the friends or even family, Jen McCabe's family. They don't come out there at all to speak to anybody, which is one of those things that is a huge controversy in this case. A lot of people think that's really weird. It's behavior like this that has sparked what some people are calling conspiracy theories to form around what could have happened. Karen says she has no motive to kill John. She loved him. Sure, their relationship had problems, like all relationships do, but she loved him. And there were other people inside that house that night who the defense says did have problems with John, Colin Albert being one of them. Colin is Brian's nephew. His father is Brian's brother. His father is the one who is the Canton selectman, and he has reportedly had run-ins before with John. One of the theories is that something happened when John got there. Maybe there was a fight or something was said. The theory is that maybe Colin started an argument or a fight, and then Brian, who's a trained MMA fighter, got involved, started to fight John, and things went too far. You'll also hear a lot of talk in this controversy about their dog, Chloe. Chloe was a German Shepherd who had been with the family for a long time, but also does have some records of not being friendly with other people. Part of the theory is that Chloe saw possibly Colin or Brian or both fighting John, and German Shepherds tend to want to protect their owners. So the theory is that Chloe then attacked John, which would be one of the explanations for how some of his injuries happened. On his right arm, he has wounds that are parallel lacerations, and these are what the defense says look like injuries from a dog. And the other wounds that are on his biceps and his forearm could not have been caused by blunt force trauma. It looks more like what could be a dog mark. Now, we don't know what clothes he had on when this happened. We don't know if there's any forensics that was done underneath the car. I'm assuming that is something that would have been done, but these are all things that at this point we don't know. Also, the defense claims that the backs of John's hands have defensive wounds because they are deeply bruised. They say it looks like a fight where he was defending himself. A reason that the dog keeps getting brought up as well is that, according to Karen's defense attorney, Chloe, the German Shepherd, was rehomed only months after this happened, after having been with the Alberts for years. The rehoming allegedly took place in the same month when the defense began to look into the injuries that John suffered. This has prompted the defense attorneys to request samples from the autopsy and a DNA sample from the dog so that they could do testing of their own. If you look at the pictures of the damage done to John's body, it's not very consistent with getting hit by a car when the car doesn't have anything visibly wrong with it other than a broken taillight. There was an original accusation that there was hair that was found in the taillight that belonged, theoretically, to John. But that has been proven that it wasn't a hair. It wasn't John's hair. It wasn't even a hair. John also had a 2-inch laceration on the back of his head. Head wounds generally cause a good bit of bleeding. And another one of the big points of contention here is that there wasn't a ton of blood everywhere, but there are notes that his clothing had blood on it. And the medical examiner actually said it was, quote, saturated with blood. The fractured skull is another big point of contention because it's hard for a lot of people to be able to agree with or picture that his skull could be fractured if he's falling in the snow and the grass. Again, keep in mind, there's no damage to the back of her car other than just the taillight. So unless there's extensive damage underneath her car, this doesn't seem like it could really happen. And even if there is extensive damage underneath her car, I think we would still need an expert to be able to explain how those injuries could happen by being run over when someone's doing a 3-point turn. And while we're talking about the 3-point turn, that's another point of contention. There's no parts of any of the original statements that show where Karen did a 3-point turn. I touched a little bit earlier on the health data from Apple, and that's another part that we are going to get into later, but just as a little clip into why there's so much controversy on this, the defense attorneys claim that the health and location data show that John's iPhone shows him going up and down stairs. Because of the location of where he was and where his phone shows he was, this would have been inside of Brian Albert's home. The prosecution is saying that there was never a point in time where John O'Keefe made it inside the home. So this is one of the things that's debated, because if he made it inside the home, obviously their entire story of what happened and Karen Reed being at fault is out the window. They're saying that they have witnesses. Everybody in the house said that he never made it in there. But defense is saying, we have these reports and it shows his location and it shows him climbing steps inside the house. The theory that something happened in the basement started gaining a little bit of traction when internet got word that there was a replacement flooring that was put in the basement not long after this night. Among some of the other controversies are missing ring footage and missing surveillance footage from cameras, such as the one from the library that could have shown whether or not Karen's taillight was actually broken. There are arguments about the cell phone data and about other members of the family who were inside the house who haven't had to give their cell phone information over. There's another Canton police officer who lives across the street, and his ring footage would have shown what happened, but his ring footage, apparently, according to him, doesn't show anything of evidentiary value. So that's another reason that people think that this is kind of suspicious. Another huge controversy is the judge in this trial. Now, small towns are small towns, and there will always be connections, but the defense has actually filed a motion asking the judge to recuse herself from this case because of her ties to the family. Judge Beverly is actually the daughter of an attorney who once represented Brian Albert's brother, who's Colin's dad in this case. So while he wasn't at the home that night, Colin is said to have been at the home that night, and the connection to the family is something that was concerning to the defense, and they felt like she was basically making her judgments with bias and favoring the prosecution. She refused to recuse herself, and they brought up more information as well. They actually brought up even the records, the public records from payments that were made. You know how you can look at different things like Venmo and PayPal and see those things. There were also some screenshots of texts where she was being called Auntie Bev by a member of the family. Again, these are all things that we're going to get into pretty deep on one of the episodes coming up. But just to point out and kind of give y'all an idea of what's ahead, it's another huge point of contention here. So a forensic toxicologist said that Karen's blood alcohol level taken on January 29th was somewhere between 0.07% and 0.08%, which would put her estimated blood alcohol level at 12:45 a.m. somewhere between 0.13% and 0.29%. And in Massachusetts, it's illegal to drive with a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or greater. So she definitely had alcohol in her system when she was driving. We also know, because we can see in the video footage, we can see her ordering drinks. The prosecution is saying that evidence is overwhelming that Karen hit John and left him to die, but that there's no evidence of him ever being inside the house or anybody else being involved in this. As far as the potential fight and him getting either attacked or fighting inside the home, the prosecution is saying, look, a fractured skull can cause bruising and black eyes. So that's not a fight. That's from his skull hitting the snowy grass, I guess, or whatever it was that his skull apparently hit. Now, you can watch people debate this kind of stuff. There's people who are very vocal in their thoughts on this. Take former prosecutor Wendy Murphy, for example. She says that the defense is destroying their own credibility with a nonsensical story and that they're just paying bloggers and PR firms to spread lies into the media in hopes that it helps their client. She says people these days just want to believe bad things about cops, so they jump to these conclusions and they run with it, but it's nonsense. They also say there's too many people involved for this to be a conspiracy, because with that many people involved in the house and in the investigation and all the people connected to it, there would be too many people involved for this to be a conspiracy that actually worked. Wendy Murphy actually even says that the theory that it's a dog attack, or that he was attacked inside and the dog was a part of it and then he was left outside, She says that that is so stupid that she compared it to a Saturday Night Live skit. As far as the time of the steps and the cell phone expert saying that there were steps taken and talking about the information that they received from John's phone, well, she says that the cell phone expert is just selling his soul for cash, and she wonders how much he got paid. She said only brain-dead jurors would believe that kind of story, and the defense expert is out of his mind. On the defense's side, they're saying there's no broken bones to John. There were no torso injuries. The body was found in the yard with grass and snow, so how does that cause such severe damage to his head? They also said that there's no damage on the Lexus except for the taillight. So what about the statements from the first responders? Well, that's another thing that is a huge debate on social media and on podcasts and anybody talking about this case. There were a dozen first responders there, and some of the people who the prosecution is labeling as conspiracy theorists are saying that the only one that was interviewed and mentioned in Proctor's report is the female firefighter, but that she is best friends with Caitlin Albert, who was, you guessed it, inside the house. There are actually photos that were dug up of them on social media together as well. And what about that Ford Edge? Why have we not heard about that until way later? Why was none of that information in any of the reports? And why did Proctor never talk to Lucky, the plow driver? And the inconsistencies in the reports. The Canton police report said that there were no fragments of taillight at 6 a.m. and no shoe. It became a state police crime scene within a few hours, and then all of a sudden Proctor, who's a friend, takes over, and at 5:45, there's more than 6 inches of snow at this point that have fallen, and now they find taillight pieces, one of them which was pretty large, and they find his shoe on top of a full foot of snow that has fallen. They also say that there are some issues with Proctor's report. Proctor's report said that he got to Karen's parents' house at 4:30 and that he had Karen's car towed at 5:30, but the Reed's alarm footage shows that it was actually towed at 4:12, leaving Proctor alone with the car for 1 hour and 18 minutes. He then took it to Canton Police Department instead of the state police department, even though they didn't have jurisdiction over it anymore. But it was the closest to them, and then all of a sudden the CERT team found pieces of taillight. Also, it's been noted that the car being taken to Canton Police Department, where Brian Higgins, who was also at the house that night, has an office, and if you'll remember, actually left that house to go to Canton Police Department to do administrative work. Also, it is where the brother of Brian Albert lives, who is also the dad of Colin, who is the one who they said had issues with John and was at the house. Do you see why I say it's so messy? That's about it for the episode today. I wanted to go over the timeline and the specifics of the timeline and kind of give you an idea of why there's so much controversy and which sides are saying what they're saying. Now, as the season progresses, we're going to take each piece of evidence and each report and each evidentiary hearing and everything that's happening, we're going to take it piece by piece and really dig in. Our next episode is going to be about the inconsistencies, because I feel like we can't really dig into the evidence part until we get all of the different versions of the story that have been given at all of the different times. So next week, that's what we're going to look into. Once we get to other pieces of evidence like the wounds and the forensics and the cell phone data, I'll bring in some experts that are used to talking about these things, used to looking at these kinds of things, and can give us some insight into their perspectives on it. I want to make sure that we cover as much of the information as we can. There are a lot of things with the prosecution story that don't make sense. There are also a lot of things with the defense's story that are questionable. I think that this is one of those cases that when you're just starting to look at it, there's so many pieces and none of it really makes sense yet. I want everybody to keep an open mind about both sides. And let's go through this season as we look at all of the evidence and the connections to people and see what matters and what doesn't. Look at it from what the jurors would see. Which pieces of evidence do you think are more important than others? Which pieces of evidence or testimony would you give more weight to when determining what you do believe? There's a lot to cover here, and this is just the beginning. I'll have some pictures up on the episode guide on 13thjurorpodcast.com. Make sure to subscribe and share and leave us a review or a 5-star rating. It helps us get the word out and get more people talking about this. Hopefully we can take a look at everything. And the biggest goal for this podcast is to really just dive into everything and hopefully help the truth come out, whatever that truth may be. My name is Brandy Churchwell. Thanks for listening, and I'll see y'all next time.
Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.